Meeting of House has to order. It's about 3:07. President Representative Vasquez, Representative Tarr, Representative Stutes, Representative Talrico, Representative Wall, myself, Chair Seaton. I want to remind everybody to turn their cell phones on silent and address any questions through the chair. Today we'll hear a presentation from the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust on Alaska's roadmap to address Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. Following that will be the first hearing on HB 76, the Governor's Council on Disabilities, and we're not intending to move that bill today, but we want to get it out so that if anybody has comments, they can be prepared at our next meeting. So with that, is there anything come forth, committee? Seeing none, can we have the commission and the Mental Health Trust come forward? Welcome, and would you put yourselves on the record? And
really?
If we are at any time going back and forth, would you please just say your name? You don't have to do a full introduction, but we have two female voices, and so it's much easier for the audio to know who's speaking. So welcome.
Thank you very much. So good afternoon, everyone. Chair Seaton, thank you for inviting us. For the record, my name is Denise Daniello. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. And with me today is
Nancy Burke, Senior Program Officer with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
And we really appreciate this opportunity to present Alaska's roadmap to address Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. This publication was just completed, and actually on December 31st, on New Year's Eve, and hopefully you have a copy of it. We sent it out to all of our legislators, and if you did not receive a copy, let me know, and I will be more than happy to forward a copy to you. Alzheimer's disease and related dementia is becoming an increasingly important public health challenge because we're having an increase in the senior population in Alaska, as we all know, and advanced age is one of the most important risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. So this roadmap is the culmination of 3 years of planning efforts. So this is a little background information about our presentation today. First, we'll talk a little bit about Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, what it is, provide an overview of the needs assessment activities that we undertook to develop the roadmap, describe the roadmap's goals and recommendations, identify next steps for implementation, and then conclude with answering any remaining questions. So this slide lists the names of the agencies and individuals who were who served on the core team and were responsible for developing the roadmap. As you can see, it's been a really collaborative team effort. We had a lot of collaboration from divisions from the Department of Health and Social Services, including Senior Disability Services, Public Health, Behavioral Health, the Alaska Commission on Aging, Senior and Disability Services, in addition to the Alaska Mental Health Authority, Office of Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Alzheimer's Resource Agency, and AARP Alaska. So based on input from various needs assessment efforts, we developed this mission for the roadmap, and it specifically includes recommendations to advance public awareness about Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, to promote prevention and early detection, to increase access to long-term services and supports, to improve access to safe and appropriate housing, reduce the burden of care on families, and address the increasing cost of care of Alzheimer's disease, because this is an area where we're going to see increasing costs to care for people with dementia. Nationally, we spend about $214 billion, and that includes about $150 billion paid for by Medicare and Medicaid, and that cost is estimated to skyrocket to $1.27 trillion by 2050 as the senior population continues to boom. So here's some information about Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. So first of all, dementia is not a disease, but it's an umbrella term to describe conditions and diseases that lead to loss of memory, loss of thinking ability, and it affects a who perform basic activities of daily living. And these changes in the brain are the result of the death of brain cells. So Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. It is responsible for about 60 to 80% of the dementia. And but there are other types of dementia too, actually 9 different types. You know, just to name a few, vascular dementia that results from stroke, frontotemporal dementia, there's Lewy body dementia, Wernicke-Korsakoff dementia that is a result of excessive alcohol use over time, and other forms. And Alzheimer's disease is a very slow and progressive disease. It could take anywhere from 4 to 6 years to run its full course, or longer with Alzheimer's disease. And the thing about Alzheimer's disease, it does not affect two people in the same way. Every person's different. This disease is the result of, again, changes in the brain that has to do with the development and accumulation of plaques, which are beta amyloid that form on the outside of neurons. And on the inside of neurons, there are tangles that form from the protein called tau. And it's these two changes in the brain that are responsible for the cutoff of neurons being able to communicate with each other, as well as to take up nutrition, and as a result, the brain cells die. So initially, this disease starts in the hippocampus area of the brain, which is the innermost area of the brain that's responsible for memory formation. And this is the reason why one of the first symptoms of Alzheimer's is short-term memory loss. Now, as the disease progresses and moves into other areas of the brain, then we get the other symptoms that are common with Alzheimer's disease, including loss of memory and language, loss of balance and higher thinking abilities, and changes in personality and behavior. So Alzheimer's disease causes significant hardship for the person who has it, as well as their family. In the advanced stages, a person loses their ability to communicate, to talk. They lose their ability to take care of themselves. They need help with everything, including eating, bathing, dressing, and so forth. And in the end, they have they're not able to swallow or to walk. They become 24. They need 24-hour bed care. And then eventually they die, usually from some other cause, such as pneumonia, because when a person doesn't move around very much, infection sets in, and in the case of Alzheimer's, it's usually in the lungs. And so that's Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. So this graph, or this slide talks about who's most at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease, and it's basically people over the age of 65, but this also is to say that Alzheimer's disease is not a common characteristic of aging. However, it does affect people who are over the age of 65, but there are also younger people who can develop Alzheimer's between the ages of 30 to 64. There's no known cure for this disease, and there's no way to slow down its development once it gets started. However, there's a growing body of research that shows that living a healthy lifestyle may help to delay the onset of symptoms, and so that's really important, such as healthy eating, good nutrition, regular exercise, social engagement, regular mental stimulating activities, get enough sleep, and reduce your stress. So this graph shows the projected senior population currently out to 2042. Our current senior population will more than double over the next 20 years, and I'm sure everybody here knows that Alaska has the fastest growing senior population, people age 65 and older. And it will, our senior population will level off around 2032. And at that time, we'll see a a spike in the number of people age 85 and older, because that's when the baby boomers will start moving into those older age brackets and be the ones who are most at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. So this chart shows that rates of Alzheimer's disease increases with age. Almost half of the Alzheimer's patients are people age 85 and older. In addition, people who are 85 and older usually have mixed dementia. So that means they have Alzheimer's disease in combination with another form of dementia, usually Parkinson's disease or vascular dementia that develops from stroke and Lewy body dementia. Women are more at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease, and this is because women live longer than men. In fact, a woman in her 60s is about twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease as she is to develop breast cancer.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Wolf.
Thank you. Just a quick question. And people, you said almost half the people 85 and over have Alzheimer's or other dementias, 46%.
So through the chair, Representative Wolf, it's actually the half of the people who have Alzheimer's disease and related dementia are in that age bracket.
Okay, thank you. My question is, at the point that someone is suffering from those, you can't differentiate Alzheimer's or the various dementias, correct? Are they easily differentiable?
Representative Will, through the chair, each one, and I'm not an expert, so let's just put that out there right now.
Okay.
Each one has its own defining characteristics. Like Lewy body dementia, people with that disease are more apt to have hallucinations and sleep disturbances. Parkinson's is noted by the tremors. And I would think that there may be some differences, too, on the PET scans, which are the images of the brain, to locate the different areas of the brain where, the condition would be more pronounced. So, like, frontotemporal dementia, which affects people who are older, would be more in the frontal areas of the brain. But, we're learning a lot. And right now we've got 9 different types of dementia that have been identified, but there may be others.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention that in addition to advanced age, there are other risk factors, too, for developing Alzheimer's disease and related dementia that include cardiovascular issues, risk factors, diabetes, head injury, and so more people are experiencing these conditions because we're having an increase in the senior population and there are more people who are surviving. So this can also increase the number of people, too, who may have Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. And some studies even suggest as much as 50%. So that could be significant.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief question because I wrote something down wrong. In the earlier slide on page 5, when you were talking about Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, I thought you said 12 different kinds.
And no, 9.
9. Okay, I heard that.
Yeah,
maybe
9 related.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And I can tell you what they all are, afterwards if you want.
Okay.
Okay.
One more question, Mr.
Representative Wall.
So in your chart with the percentages, if that's, where's the other 37%?
Oh, that's good. Yeah. We got these statistics from the National Alzheimer's Association. They're average rates. So
Mr. Nell?
I think it might also be due to, the related dementias, too. Related dementias and
okay.
Early onset.
Denise? The question, I think, is, does these percentages mean that 46% of those over 85 have dementia? Or are you saying that 46% of all dementias are?
Yes, the second, have Alzheimer's. So this is just for rates of Alzheimer's disease that's prevalent among people with Alzheimer's disease. So it's not to say that half of people age 85 and older have Alzheimer's. So this chart shows the number of people that we estimate may have Alzheimer's disease in Alaska who are age 65 and older. And these rates, these numbers come from the National Alzheimer's Association. So currently there are about 6,100, and over the next 10 years we're almost double that population to 11,000. So that's about an 8% increase annually. This graph doesn't include the number of people with related dementias or early onset Alzheimer's, which affects people between the ages of 30 to 64. If we added those numbers in, the Alzheimer's Resource Agency estimates there are about 8,000 Alaskans right now with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia.
Representative Stoops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you attribute the almost doubling of Alzheimer's in the next 10 years to the aging of the population?
The aging of the population has definitely a lot to do with it, and which is responsible for the growing number of people with Alzheimer's disease. In addition, Alzheimer's disease, there is also the relationship with head injury, with diabetes, with chronic health conditions, even depression. And there is also, you know, a growing number of those people, too, with those conditions, which can increase the numbers even more. So this is a pretty conservative estimate of people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, and I'll just kind of go out on a limb on this, but Alaska is the state with the fastest growing senior population of age 65 and older. So in the future, we may be one of the leading states with the fastest growing population of older people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, especially when we get out a few more years and we have our baby boomers get into those years of highest risk. And I wanted to mention, too, that in Alaska, about one-third of people who have Alzheimer's disease and related dementia who live in the community live by themselves. They don't live with anybody. So this chart looks at the death rates for over the last 10 years. And what we're seeing is that there's been an increase in the mortality rate for people for Alzheimer's disease, which is basically due to the increasing senior population. At the same time, we're seeing a decrease in mortality related to cancer, heart disease, and stroke. So now,
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that previous slide, if we're looking at that increase, of course, as the population is aging, that makes sense. But what are the actual health, what's the actual thing that, if you're saying it's Alzheimer's that was the cause of death, what's the actual health problem that that's being attributed to?
Well, Alzheimer's disease can be related to a number of different health problems. Usually the cause of death for a person with Alzheimer's is pneumonia.
Okay, that's what I wondered.
So, you know, our mortality rates are probably lower than what there is, you know, really. So now in this next section, we'd like to share with you the needs assessment activities that we undertook to develop the roadmap. And we basically did three different types of needs assessment activities to gather both quantitative and qualitative data. And the first one was the holding of these community forums across the state. We held 7 community forums in the locations listed here. We had 161 people in total attend these forums who represented families who were taking care of loved ones at home with dementia, also professional caregivers, people with early stage dementia, and members of the public. So we learned a lot from these forums from participants. First of all, we learned that there's a general lack of public awareness and misunderstanding about Alzheimer's disease that oftentimes leads to stigma and embarrassment for the person who's affected and their family, and that leads to denial that the condition exists. And it's that denial that oftentimes stands in the way of that person and their family accessing services that could help, you know, because we don't have a treatment or a cure. At least the services do help. Secondly, we heard a lot from family caregivers about inadequate services for people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, particularly from people who live in rural remote communities, as well as the need for specialized services for people with Alzheimer's that are called queuing and supervision. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation. But oftentimes people with Alzheimer's or other forms of cognitive impairment have functional limitations. They're able to do activities like getting dressed, for example, but they may not get, you know, put on the right clothes or may not be able to button their shirts right or so forth, but they need someone to help prompt them through the activity. Family caregivers also told us that they feel very stressed and unprepared to take on the responsibilities of caring for a loved one at home because they lack the training and support such as respite, and they were concerned about the financial burden of providing that care. People also talked a lot about the need for safe and appropriate housing, especially assisted living homes with memory care beds. As we all know, the state's Pioneer Homes have wait lists that are very long. Here in Juneau, we have the Pioneer Homes, but not too many other options for seniors who need assisted living and memory care. We also have few licensed facilities in the state to care for seniors with dementia and challenging behaviors that can be compounded by mental illness. And finally, people also talked about the need to improve safety for people with Alzheimer's disease who may have a tendency to wander and then find themselves in life-threatening situations. And that was particularly important issue for people who attended the Fairbanks Community Forum because they had lost an elder that previous winter due to wandering. The second assessment that we did was we sent out a family caregiver survey. And this family caregiver survey, we had 52 people who responded to that survey. They were mostly women, 62%. Half of them had some college education. 70% were in a long-term relationship. They were well-seasoned caregivers. They provided care for about 4 years. And we asked them, what's the most difficult challenge you face as a caregiver of a loved one with dementia? And they said stress. And that stress leads to depression. And so that was the most significant challenge, and that's consistent with national findings as well. And then you could also see the other challenges that they face too. We also asked family caregivers about the types of services that they need, and almost one-third of the caregiver respondents said adult day was the most important service, followed by transportation, support groups, personal care assistance, along with respite. The third needs assessment activity and the final one was the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. So a couple of years ago, the Commission and the Division of Public Health put together and obtained funding to include a 10-question module about perceived cognitive impairment in the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, or BRFIS. And this was significant because this was the first time that the state has ever received information, surveillance information, about perceived cognitive impairment in our state. And we defined perceived cognitive impairment for purposes of this survey as memory loss that was getting was progressively getting worse. And that definition is probably more expansive than what Alzheimer's disease and related dementia involves, but is significant because it helps us to understand the relationship between memory loss and health health indicators, about memory loss and how it affects people's daily lives, and if they if people with memory loss, if they access care. So what this graph shows is that in the later ages, the percent of people with perceived cognitive impairment increases for people aged 70 years and older. And across all age groups, about 9% of people have perceived cognitive impairment. So this would also include brain injury. So the BRFA survey also looked at perceived cognitive impairment and health condition, and we found that people with perceived cognitive impairment, there was an increased likelihood of them being smokers, having a diagnosis of depression, also having cardiovascular health issues. And finally, we looked at the impacts to daily life for people with perceived cognitive impairment, and we found that it definitely affects people's daily lives. It affects their ability to work, to engage in social activities, their ability to perform regular household chores, to independently care for themselves, and it also results in increased mental distress. And we also took a look at the different types of programs that people with dementia use that are administered by the Department of Health and Social Services. And we found that the most prevalent used services include the Pioneer Homes, of course, and then Adult Day Services, followed by the National Family Caregiver Grant Program, and that's a senior grant program administered by the Division of Senior and Disability Services that provides respite for family caregivers.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, in terms of, you know, the actual number of facilities that offer these type of services, how much of the need do you think is actually met? So if people are saying, right, adult day services is the most important, you know, how much unmet need is there in that category of service?
I think that's an excellent question, Representative Tarr, through the chair. And it's kind of an unknown right now. Mm-hmm. And it's something that will be looked at in the future, I believe, as we continue on planning for services. Right now, the Adult Day Program, if I remember correctly, for the last fiscal year served 416 seniors statewide, 13 Adult Day Programs, of which 66% had Alzheimer's disease and related dementia.
Representative Vasquez.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
What's the breakdown for Anchorage?
I don't know that offhand, but for Adult Day?
Yes.
I can look for that, or if I can call on a lifeline, I don't know if she knows. Angela Salerno, do you know? No. So we'll have to get back with you.
Okay. I was interested in the same figures, how many Adult Day care centers there are in Anchorage, and how many participants, and what type of waiting list do they have.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, and just to follow up on that, and what has me thinking about this is just with these projections, mm-hmm. with knowing we have the fastest growing senior population, and then these projections, you know, if there's an unmet need now, how can we be ahead of the curve, so to speak, on this issue, and be forward thinking so that providers or other facilities and programs, you know, will start to transition to be thinking about having more participants and make sure we don't have a huge gap, you know, in just a few years.
Yeah. Representative Tarr, I agree with you through the chair. And nationally, you know, there's people with Alzheimer's disease and related to dementia are about 18 times more at risk for being in the nursing home. So the more that we can serve people through these lower ends of care, home and community-based services, which, you know, are less costly, as this next slide shows, $599 per person on average, you know, for the basic core services, the better off we are. Mm-hmm. You know, the more that we can, the longer that we can serve people in the community, the more, and the more that we can support family caregivers to take care of their loved ones at home, mm-hmm. that will be a cost savings. Mm-hmm. So this graph shows the average annual cost per different types of services for people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. And on the left side is the, you know, are the senior grant programs that provide those essential core services such as meals, rides, homemaker services, case management and respite for family caregivers. And then people with Alzheimer's disease who income qualify, who need assisted living, may be served through general relief. Particularly those who do not qualify for the level of care requirements through the current waiver program, and people with Alzheimer's disease who need hands-on assistance can be served through personal care assistance, also through the waiver program, then up to the Pioneer Homes, through State 6 Pioneer Homes, and skilled nursing care. So just kind of as a wrap up before we move into the next section, you know, why is this roadmap to address Alzheimer's disease important? Well, we feel it's important because this is the first ever statewide planning process to address the needs of people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. And this is, you know, a growing population of vulnerable people that will increase the cost of care in Alaska. We don't have, you know, any cure or prevention for Alzheimer's disease, and it creates a severe hardship for people who are impacted by the disease as well as their families. So this roadmap aims to increase public awareness about Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, to understand the current impact about Alzheimer's disease in Alaska, and to have a set of goals, recommendations, and performance measures that we can use to address this condition in a comprehensive way. And Nancy's going to now take over and talk about the roadmap's goals.
Again, for the record, this is Nancy Burke with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And so the planning group that you saw on the second slide, which comprised many stakeholders, settled on just six goals out of many, many other options. And they include the first goal being to promote public awareness of prevention and early diagnoses of Alzheimer's disease and related dementia conditions. But in this goal, public awareness around not only early indicators of the disease, but also healthier lifestyle choices such as diet, exercise, paying attention to sleep is another big one. And we also know some of the research for northern climates. I know we've heard vitamin D discussed in this committee, that all of these comprise a picture of healthy lifestyle that can be promoted to the population in general. The second one is to improve access to affordable housing and services supports for individuals with Alzheimer's disease at all stages of the disease. And as you saw from the slide, the better prepared we are to provide in-home supports, the lower the cost to the state. So programs such as caregiver support, respite care, even personal care assistance for individuals to remain in their homes saves us a tremendous amount of resource compared to the higher priced assisted living and nursing facility care. The third goal is to optimize the quality and safety and efficiency of services for people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. We're really a fairly young state in developing some more technical care for people with Alzheimer's disease and dementia and other conditions, and we see these folks falling out of the system and hitting emergency placements such as API or the hospitals, and it's an indicator to us that we need more specific technical care for the individuals. And that relates to the next goal, which is to develop a long-term care workforce trained in dementia care so that we can better serve these folks, and to improve family and other informal caregivers. And lastly, to increase monitoring and research into Alzheimer's disease and related dementia prevalence, cost of care, prevention, and treatment. There were seven prioritized strategies that came out of it, and rather than walk through each of these individually, I'd like to just call your attention to the fact that this partnership really did result in our strategies. So we have the Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska focusing on education and prevention, which is pretty much in their wheelhouse. That's what they do on a daily basis. The trust is assisting the department, our planning boards, in looking at potential 1915I and 1915K state plan options through Medicaid services. Senior and Disability Services is looking at resource needed for to assure that we can provide those lower-level services to individuals for the long term. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman is looking at an arena where they see by assisted living home regulations and how we might improve regulations in those areas. The Pioneer Home is looking at dementia-specific care and how we might increase the skill set of providers across the state. AARP is looking how they might support members in home and to increase services that might reduce the stress impacting families caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease. And the Commission on Aging is looking at in-home respite and adult day services strategies. We'd like to talk just for a minute about the goal 211 that the trust is assisting our partner boards. And I'd like to say that this is a great example of how the trust is really helping underpin the work of our partner boards, and the Commission on Aging has been the lead in this plan. We've really been appreciative of their leadership and wanting to support what we can. And what we can provide is some resources, and we have projects out looking right now at how we might better use the 1915K or 1915I option. And what's significant about these two options is it really does help us drill the services closer to those in-home support services. Right now, our existing waiver programs are not able to serve individuals with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia until they reach a point where they are physically unable to care for themselves, which is the bar, if you will, for our current waiver system. The 1915 I and K options moves it closer to the home. People are able to receive services before they reach those later physical, the point at which the disease is impacting their physical abilities. We're able to support them for longer in their homes through these state plan options. They also provide us with access to greater federal match, and they bring us closer to compliance with some of the federal requirements around conflict-free case management and the home, the settings rules for where services need to be provided. So the next steps, we view this document as a living document. We really are striving to not have this sit on a shelf. We want each of our partners who are facilitating the strategies to come together regularly to encourage others to be a part of the strategies and to really move this forward. And it's a critical time. There are a lot of things changing in the system right now, and we can be very effective in changing services for people who have Alzheimer's disease in the state.
And thank you.
Questions from the committee? I guess I have one.
Sure.
Looking at your seven prioritized strategies, if you'd go back to that. Educate Alaskans about prevention. You know, we've worked in here quite a bit on moving upstream and looking at causes and prevention, and I'm hearing the message that we don't have any cures or preventions. I heard the statement that stress was related to or caused Alzheimer's. I can't remember exactly what that was. And yet, you know, we've submitted to both the Mental Health Trust and to the Commission a number of articles, recent articles, on looking at vitamin D and lowering the risk by half, and lowering the speed of Alzheimer's developing by half. A large study that was just published in Neurology in 2014, I guess that was, I think that was August of 2014. We have another study looking at the resorption of beta amyloid plaques with treatment of vitamin D. We have another study that was looking at systematic review of a number of studies that showed that lower vitamin D levels significantly higher proportion of people develop Alzheimer's and related dementias. And yet, in this entire presentation, other than skipping over, it was, well, there's nothing we can do, we're just going to treat. And so I'm wondering how you balance that, or I haven't seen the studies that are at all scientifically based that says stress is the cause of Alzheimer's, yet stress was related here as something that was definitely related. So I'm trying to figure out how we look at the mechanisms in which we are picking and choosing things that we want to say are related to Alzheimer's and those that have scientific bases that we are not including. And so I want to give you both the opportunity to address that concern.
Well, I guess I can start. Healthy lifestyles. We used to have the commission used to have a campaign. We called it the Healthy Body, Healthy Brain campaign. This was a few years ago. I don't know if you remember it, but it focused on the importance of a healthy lifestyle in order to reduce risk for Alzheimer's disease, but also, you know, for brain health. And so we found, and there's a lot of research out there that looks at the benefits of a healthy lifestyle. You know, good nutrition, exercise, regular mental engagement, and so forth. To me, I think one of the important things that we can do in terms of this roadmap is to encourage people to regularly visit their doctor, to make sure they get their annual exam and get their blood work done, and to make sure that they, you know, have the proper nutrients in their bodies, like vitamin D, as well as other, you know, cholesterol, because cardiovascular disease is definitely implicated with dementia through vascular dementia. So I think it's important, you know, that we look at a person's health holistically and to encourage them to have that important conversation with their doctor.
Representative Seaton, I was thinking it's a fair critique that, you know, is that I think about our work at the Trust, we are trying to figure out how to work more in prevention, because you can, as you're pointing out, you can prevent a lot of what ends up being problematic in the system. We get a little zeroed in on who's in the system, who's already being served, and it's a fair critique that we should be paying more attention to the science and promoting the research that's available.
Well, and I appreciate that, and I guess what I'm just a little concerned about is we talk in broad sweeping generalities, be healthy, and that will help you. But when we have scientific studies mm-hmm. that particularly associate, and in fact randomized control trials that show that there's a different relationship, and we ignore those as specific recommendations for Alaskans, we are basically saying, well, be healthy and there's nothing we can do. And I think that's a wrong message that is being received, but that's what's being received when people say, oh, just have a healthy lifestyle, and that's not a message that's going to cause any action by people, because it's a, you know, it's too broad a message to really let anybody act on that message, or people won't act on that message, I feel. So anyway, I encourage you to both the Mental Health Trust and the Commission to actually pick out options that, that they want to support that are scientifically justified and have some scientific bases, especially those that are cheap. I mean, 3 cents a day gets everybody into the range where the study that came out in neurology means that the risk would be half of what it would be, and for those that are developing dementia, the rate would be half of the rate. That that was a 6.5-year study, and both in the rapidity of the development and the risk of developing either all-cause dementia or Alzheimer's specifically, the risk was half. So it seems to me that if we are looking at prevention of 50%, that's a whole lot better target than a target that doesn't have any percentages or any amounts next to it. So I just want to make sure that we're all progressing forward. Do other committee members have questions? Seeing none, we appreciate you coming forward, and we really know that this is a very significant disease that is affecting numerous Alaskans, and we're several of us around the table are getting white hair and beards and things and mustaches, so that we know at least it is on the horizon that we want to prevent. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
And now we will go to House Bill 76. Do we have the sponsor or representative the sponsor here? And again, our purpose in bringing forward House Bill 76 is to consider the bill and then to put it on the record, any questions, and we'll put it aside for the next committee so that the public will have opportunity to comment to us. Would you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead?
Absolutely. Good afternoon. My name is Grace Abbott, and I'm staff to Representative Charisse Millett. Representative Millett apologizes for not being able to be here today and sends her regards. Thank you so much for hearing House Bill 76 today, which, in short, removes the word gifted from the enabling statutes for the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. The Governor's Council, since its creation in 1978, has and continues to advocate for and access housing, employment, independent living, health, transportation, and community inclusion for Alaskans with disabilities. However, within their enabling statutes, gifted or exceptional students were included among the individuals that the Council need work for and support. Since that time, 1978, legislation has been passed, an administrative code has been adopted within the Department of Education to empower and support gifted education and gifted students through their school districts, none of which includes council participation or oversight. Meanwhile, the council has provided a constructive process that has connected policymakers, the public, and has delivered services to meet the needs of Alaskans with disabilities. House Bill 78 aims to reconcile the Council's enabling statutes with their mission to best reflect the immense service that we'd like the Council to continue to provide and to clean up confusing language. This will not only support our current Council, but also provides a clear roadmap for future Councils and their membership. I'm joined online by Patrick Reinhart, who's the current Executive Director of the Council, and Christy Reinhart, who is on his staff, for further testimony or to answer any questions or provide any clarifications.
Are there questions? I guess on I just had a clarification on page 2. Line 14 is repeated throughout. The changing of the citation there is just updating the reference in the Federal Registry. Is that correct?
Chair Seaton, yes, sir. That's absolutely just an update that was needed and found place in this bill. The policy is the same at the federal level, but after an overhaul of the U.S. code, they needed to update the statute to reflect the most current policy in our statutes.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Not seeing any, so we have online Patrick Reinhart with the Governor's Council on Disabilities. Are you online?
Yes, Representative Seaton. My name is Patrick Reinhart, the Executive Director of the Governor's Council, and as Grace stated, with me is our education specialist here at the Council, who works on special education issues for the Council, Christy Reinhart. We're not related. Our names are spelled differently, but we want to let you know that we are here, and I think that Ms. Abbott did a fine job representing what the aim is here, and as she said, it's really kind of cleaning up our mission versus what's in our statute so that we don't get confusion on the public, which sometimes happens, and so this has kind of been on our agenda to fix for a while, and it seemed like a good opportunity to ask this year.
Thank you, and just for clarification, you said your names were spelled differently. Were you talking about your first names or your last names?
Thank you, Representative. Yeah, the last names. I'm Patrick Reinhart, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-T, and Christy is, first C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E, and her last name, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-D-T. It's just a coincidence.
No, that's fine. It was entered as the same last name here. That's why I was wanting to get the record corrected. So thank you. So does anybody have any questions for Patrick? Seeing none, thank you very much. How about Christy? Did you have a testimony you'd like to offer?
Yes, thank you, Representative Seaton and the committee. I'm Christy Reinhart, and I'm staff for the council. I am technically staff for the Special Education Advisory Panel. One of the responsibilities of the council is to be the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act stakeholder group that oversees and advises special education. So we are federally mandated. Every single state is required to have a special education advisory panel. Alaska is the only state where the CAP resides with the DD Council. We have a unique role. Our job is really to advise and administer special education programs within the state. And we've had a conflict because in 2002 there were regulatory changes made within state education regulations in response to statutory changes that removed gifted and talented education from special education and related services. So gifted and talented exceptionality is no longer considered a disability program. And so they're two entirely separate programs. One of them has very complicated and mandated federal and state statutes and regulations and policies and procedures. And that would be special education. And in the state of Alaska, gifted and talented is primarily, those policies are primarily developed and administered by your local education agency or your school district. They're funded completely differently, and while there are dual exceptionalities, individuals with a disability who will also be gifted and talented, there's very little overlap between the two programs. One of the problems that we've seen is that Alaska, in its gifted and talented programs, because there is very little state oversight, there's often confusion from stakeholders, primarily from parents, who have concerns about the quality of their school or their school district's gifted and talented education. There's no gifted and talented education program. There's no gifted and talented education advisory committee. There's no specified mandated funding. And so this has put us in a very tricky position where we understand the concerns of parents with their children's education, but it does not fall within a purview of something that we are able to effectively advise, monitor, or advocate for.
Thank you. Are there questions for Christy? And Christy, the fact that the Council on Disabilities is the overseer or the funding conduit, and that's unique to Alaska, is that working well? Is that an efficient process that is followed, or do the other states have it right?
For us, it's a fantastic partnership. I think because we're able to work very closely with our early intervention program, overseeing the infant learning and early intervention program and the education, as well as some of the other programs here at the council, which involves housing, transportation, and employment, that looks at across the lifespan supports for individuals with a disability. We know that kids in school are going to be transitioning into the workforce, and so it's, I think, a really great place that this state is small enough for this kind of work to be done within one centralized agency. One of the real benefits about that is that our special education advisory panel is different than some other states. The requirement by the federal government is that we meet quarterly, and in this state we meet once a month, and we have a very active group. We are a working group that are really a large number of committed individuals who are really invested in quality special education services within the state.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this changing of the designation and removing gifted from the title, that would release the responsibility of this council to, as you mentioned earlier, parents of gifted children were stating there's not enough resources. So therefore, this council and funding would not be used for gifted children. Is that one of the purposes of the change?
Well, one of the purposes of the change is that the advocacy route is different, and built within the special, within the gifted and talented requirements for the local education agency or the school district is that they have to have a review plan. That plan would be administered directly by the local school boards rather than overseen by the state. And we work at a much more state and policy level than influencing local school boards. And the other difference is that there's special education funding comes from both a federal and a state match. While there is no designated funding for gifted and talented education, local school districts are able to access gifted and talented funding through their Title V funds. It's actually Title V Part D, Subsection 6. So while there is funding, it's the determination of the local at the local level about how that money is spent.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further, Representative Vasquez?
What is the total budget for the council?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, this is Patrick Brenner, the executive director. Our total budget for the council is just shy of $2.1 million, and our responsibility related to the special education advisory panel that Christy talked about is a pass-through amount that we get from the state, from the federal government to the State Department of Ed. And I don't have the budget numbers here in front of me, but I believe it's $170,000 for that particular aspect of it. So as Christy talked about, we're kind of a multi-level council that combined a lot of different responsibilities into one. But the CEAP, the Special Education Advisory Panel, is one aspect of that total budget, if that answers your question.
Yes, but how much is general funds, state funds? And how much?
Actually, Representative Vasquez, to the chair, we are one of those councils that are rare. We don't have any general funds involved in our entire budget. They are all either federal funds that pass through the state and or mental health trust funding for various categories. So if we have 10 different funding sources, none of them are general fund dollars.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Patrick and Christy, for calling in. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 76? I'm going to close public testimony, but we will reopen it if anyone comes online next time we take up the bill. We anticipate that being on Thursday. So I'm going to close public testimony at this time. Is there any committee discussion on House Bill 76? Seeing none, anything else further to come before the committee? Seeing nothing, it is 4:09, and we will be adjourned. Thank you very much.